Okay, the idea between, about this meeting is that for maybe 99% of the time that the program's been operative, we've been in an expository mode. People have come in and given lectures of various durations and exposed themselves to questions and generated discussion, but there comes a time, I think, where we ought to be asking ourselves where we are, what we've learned, where the field, and if not our individual research, should go from this point. So this is an effort to now start to become a little more critical and evaluative about the field, and to try to understand what really ought to be done next in order to make some progress. Okay? And at the beginning of the program, that is in fact in the proposal that Eckert, Alexander, and I, and Ben Keller wrote, we had phrased what we considered to be open questions. It's not clear if they were the appropriate ones, but at the moment, they're the ones that we have. And I thought that one way to start this discussion would be to revisit those questions. But I think this is meant to be a discussion, and I think we ought to let the discussion lead its own life. And if we're taken, in one direction or another, we should go. Okay, so the first two pages are just here's the first page of open questions, and they're not particularly ranked in order of importance, and some of them may not be regarded by you as important at all, and others may be exactly what we ought to be focusing on in the future. So, can I have some comments about any of these from those of you who might have an opinion?
Well, maybe I can just make some comments, and then we can see if that provokes some controversy.
Good.
So, I do think that both in Aeolian flows as well as in aquatic flows, we have made some progress regarding the dilute regime. So when it comes to fairly small volume fractions of particles, it seems like we have a reasonably good understanding of what's going on, and we do have also reasonably advanced capabilities with regard to modeling such flows. Either through continuum formulations or through Lagrangian formulations. But of course, the really tough and challenging part is the part right next to the bed. And I think in that part, both for Aeolian and aquatic flows, there's still lots of questions that we don't quite know at this point regarding the flow particle interaction. So I see a clear need there for more investigations, both regarding the flow particle interaction once the particles are in motion, but also specifically regarding the erosion of particles. We still seem to work mostly with the Shields stress and Shields number as a criterion, but there does not seem to be a very detailed understanding yet of the physical mechanisms that really do lead to the erosion of particles and to the resuspension. In that context, I really did enjoy the experiments that yours showed earlier when you focused on individual particles and particles settling down on a wall and creating a vortex ring, and that might set other particles into motion. So showing that particles can cause each other to move without even any direct collision forces and so on. So I think, you know, from my own preference is always to try to understand the basic physical mechanisms that drive these kinds of phenomena. And looking at the small scale interaction between flow and particles in the dense regime. I think that's something where we can still learn a lot.
Yes, right.
I'll say something.
Yeah.
I think part of the issue seems to me that since I've been here and I've been thinking about river dunes, for example, is the scale issue. In terms of, for example, comparing laboratory investigations and field data, I think there's still a huge gap between those, and it's clear to me in a variety of different areas that what we see in the field in rivers, for example, if they're 10 meters deep, it's not really feasible to replicate that in a flume that's 10 centimeters deep. And I think that I would like to see the, and one way perhaps of reaching that gap is through the numerical model. Because there doesn't seem to be a way of scaling up some of these features in the lab so that they replicate what's going on in the field. Different processes seem to take over and become more important. So yeah, the issue of scale, certainly between the field and the lab, and the potential for modeling to bridge that.
That's a really key point, is what can we scale between the lab and the field? If you really understood the physics, which you'd hope to be able to scale most of the lab phenomena to field phenomena to allow scale. You can't do that. You're missing something.
And I think there's also been perhaps an overemphasis on lab scale because it's difficult to get data from the field. So people are focused on trying to understand the physics and then testing what they think they understand about the physics with lab data, and the lab data don't necessarily reflect what's going on in the field.
Okay.
Yeah, the Indian geomorphologist, I think the guy represents the field more than the equations.
Me too.
we find actually in the field two main Aeolian deposits. We find the Lurs, which is a deposit of dust, coarse dust mostly, and dunes, sand dunes. The difference, of course, is the Lurs is a result of suspension, deposition from suspension, and sand dunes, bedrock. Now, all the tunes in the field, either in North America or in Europe, you can see that they are located downwind of the less is located downwind of the sand dunes. And one idea is that the impact of subtation can create smaller particles that can eventually be in suspension and of course move much more downwind and settle in the place, where, let's say, where there is vegetation, something like that, where they can form thick deposits of less. Now, this is a very important question because today, in the what I call the current sandstorm that you see in the field, you don't see this mechanism. But we know that in the past, during much colder periods, the wind was much stronger. There are a lot of indication that the wind was much stronger than today. Today we live in a period where the wind is very relatively, or we can say the wind power is very, very, very low. So this actually was formed in the past in conditions that we don't find today. And maybe something like that should be simulated either in the laboratory or by the
you mean you talk about
the
fragmentation of the sand into
yeah.
Fiber?
Yeah.
It's the same.
I mean the particle subtation and ballistic move and the impact of one mostly quartz grain by the other can create this.
Kel, did you have?
Yeah, I have a comment about what can be found today and in the past.
I disagree with Arne. If you go to northern Greenland, you can find places where if there's a storm, you have to seek shelter. I've seen a bus being cut into two, the sides have gone because of saltating gravel. So it's just a matter of being, basically you'll die if you're out in a gravel storm up there, because when the wind really gets very strong, 3, 4, 5 millimeter grains will go partly into suspension, and then it's pretty nasty to be there. So I think we should think of it in terms that there are different regimes where different processes will happen. And today, those regimes are just located at places where it's not generally nice to be, like in northern Greenland is a very unpleasant place. So
how would the deposition pattern look?
Not all that different. But you can, now I know very little about deposition of gravel in terms of what we see from the past, but I assume that what you see today in those regions will be the same as you can see close to a former ice border in the past. So it's a matter of which kind of climatic region you are in, and those regions have just shifted. So today, where you find the sand desert, where you find most of the deserts, is in regions where it's generally in the subtropical regions where the winds are generally low. But there is another regime in the dry, cold region as well.
I wanted to return to some of the points that you raised, that if you don't mind, because this seems like focusing on historic and extreme events on one hand, but taking into account that there is a mechanism that you've raised, time that ought to be explained and is important in the field. But coming back to what you said, Eckhard, is that we do seem to have some certain knowledge about the dilute regime. How can we extend it? I mean, given that we know something there, can we move away from that with some confidence, computationally or experimentally? So could you address the computational challenges of moving away from the dilute regime?
Yes, I guess the challenges, there are a few challenges. So when we move away from the dilute regime, in the dilute regime, typically what we do is we model the particulate phase as a continuum field. And that makes the numerical solution relatively cheap, as opposed to an approach where we would track individual particles. But algorithms have become much better, and computers have become much faster. So in recent years, people have started to do simulations where they track maybe on the order of a few hundred or even a couple of thousand particles individually, and do a fairly good job resolving the interaction with the fluid and the collisions with other particles.
So, can I ask a question there? Yeah. And is that approach taken because there is not confidence in the Eulerian approach to the problem?
Because when we do the Eulerian approach, there are many, the easy way, of course, which I have done and many others as well, is to look at very small particles without inertia, when you can essentially assume the particles follow the fluid motion, plus they have a superimposed settling velocity. But that does not hold when the particles become larger, when particle inertia becomes important. And already at that point, then, it becomes much more difficult to develop an Eulerian formulation, because then essentially you have to solve separate equations for the two different phases, and you need closure terms between the two different phases. Those terms are tough to determine experimentally or from first principles theoretically. So I think that is one reason why people have looked at into doing these simulations where many particles are being tracked explicitly. But of course, even if you can track a few hundred and a few thousand particles explicitly and study their collisions and interactions with the fluid, that is still a very, very small element of a real flow field. So the question then arises as to how do we upscale these things, right? How do we go from these very small systems involving a few hundred particles in order to learn something about macroscopic behavior? And I think that's where the challenge is. Traditional upscaling techniques for turbulent flow fields in CFD involve turbulence modeling, and there are some more or less well-established approaches, RANS approach or MES approach, but these things don't work when we have two-phase flows with discrete particles moving with inertia and so on. So that's where the challenges are. So I think we can make some progress looking at very small phenomena, and I think it would be nice to do some fairly detailed comparisons such highly resolved simulations. I thought in that regard, yes, Alberto's experimental talk really showed a lot of very nice data that would be amenable to more detailed experimental and numerical computations. And hopefully those kinds of things will help us understand mechanisms that are active, which we then can try to upscale. So I think that's where the challenge is from the computational side these days.
Thank you. Jim?
Yeah, I mean, so following on from that, these simulations are fantastic in that they give you all of the information. And the same way with the granular simulations, you can get everything, you can test logics and develop particular theories. Maybe that's one of the most useful things for these simulation techniques. Because in a way, if you're trying to go to a Eulerian system, you know the form that the equations must have, purely in some sense of tensor invariance property. It's just the question of, you know, what are the transport coefficients there, and with the right type of simulations, you know, whether it's periodic cells or forced periodic cells and everything, you could address each individual, the effect of each individual term, going with direct simulations to form a parameterization. And in a way, the DNS has been very useful for developing turbulence closures, which, you know, then tested work very well. Maybe these direct simulations have been a very good way of developing.
I think it also would be, well, I shouldn't talk so much, so I'll shut up after this, but it would also be interesting to look more at what are the fundamental differences between Aeolian systems and aquatic systems. So for example, I thought it was very interesting the experiments that Dave Morey showed towards the beginning of the program. Perhaps you remember, he looked at a pile of sand falling apart in a water environment, and how that process happened very differently if he just took regular sand or if he knocked on the experimental apparatus a couple of times, which just caused some slight consolidation of the sediment, and then the process emerged completely differently. Do these things happen in the Aeolian systems as well, or is that not such a big issue whether sand is consolidated or not consolidated? Is that also, does that have a big effect in the Aeolian systems?
In the system, what you get is actually loose cell. Only loose cell can move.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to the main subtropical desert, like the Sahara Desert, where we find most of the biggest, what we call senses, which are used, huge areas covered by many meters of sand, you can find that they are all located in depressions, and during probably more longer period, there was a lot of sediment carried by floods into these depressions, and later on during dry periods, the wind start to sort the particles. So the fine particles are moved by suspension and they left the area. The sand-sized particles started to sortate and eventually accumulated into sand dunes.
Now, can I move back to Eckert or Jim. And so my question is, the numerical simulation seem to be working, direct numerical simulation seem to be working very well for Boussinesq systems. Is it a great challenge to move them to non-Boussinesq system? Isn't that the next, would that be the next step in a hierarchy of modeling? Or
the direct simulations where they are with the particles.
So there's not a problem with that.
It's hard
well, to be well, it's not so much of a problem.
But this difference between the dilatancy effect is massive in liquids. You don't see it in air because you have to have such small particles that they become cohesive. But there are some experiments which would be very hard, which would be a great test of simulations when these shape and manual experiments, people did a lot of in the 90s. Some of them, if you take out the air from your container,
there's an effect. Yes.
Effect. So this would be a really tough test, the simulation to get right.
Auditorium.
So they said, I guess the other sort of experiments are the easiest, what they the shape ones, but then there's sort of fluidized bed ones. And they're probably the easiest, strongly coupled, fluid granular experiments to do.
Yeah.
And they have those transitions and everything else. To get those right in the model, and to get those, yeah, to make you nearly model to correctly predict those transitions, be a really good test.
Yeah, I mean, I believe in the possibility of getting Eulerian models, but I don't know that that's a shared belief. I think the fact that Eckert and others are interested in getting the Eulerian Lagrangian systems going is an indication that you don't really believe that an Eulerian formulation is achievable in these systems.
I do feel, well, it always depends on what you want to do with these things. So for fundamental investigations of, you know, trying to understand the physics, I think that there may be better tools evolving than these two-phase Eulerian formulations. But for practical applications, when you want to design some equipment or something or study large-scale phenomena, I think we don't really have much of an alternative to using.
That may be a key point. I mean, there are different roles that these different simulations can play, and of necessity in the large scale problems that we're talking about, we're going to need something other than direct numerical simulation. It's fair to say that. Alexandra, would you comment on something? So,
Eckert raised the issue
of the bed, okay? And it seems to me that in Aeolian systems, we're beginning to understand the bed to some degree.
Yeah.
The particles interacting with the bed.
Oh. Very good description about the transport process, at least in study and food. So we're trying to understand the attraction between the excitation particle and the bed, and we have a fairly good description, and we can predict with fairly good accuracies in the experiment, at least in human time. But I think an important issue is the case of instable transport. When you don't have a balance between erosion and deposition. So that's it. I mean, still an open question, at least in the organ transport. To know what are the mechanisms which drive the relaxation process. For example, if you increase suddenly the wind shear stress, or whether you have a different type of bed, because for example, if you're in transition between a rigid bed and an erodible bed, so what are the mechanisms which drives the relaxation process to the new equilibrium? So for sure, there is an inertia which governs, and the inertia is important in organ transport, but also the what we call the collision. The collision is an effective process in organ transport. So by a collision of synthetic grain, you can eject some grain from the bed. And this is also another limiting factor for the relaxation.
if your salary increase or the stress test. So you should increase the number of grain in the sanitation cloth. And this process of increase of the concentration is limited by the starch process.
Is there anything to be learned about the bed in aquatic systems from what we know about the bed in aeolian systems?
In aquatic systems, the role of the impact process, the collision process, is almost ineffective.
So in aeolian systems, the inertia of the particles is really playing the dominant role. The viscosity of the fluid is essentially negligible. So that's really the difference. So we can't learn too much. Is that, I mean...
Can I ask some question about suspension in a, the aeolian case and the subaqueous? Because when we talk about suspension in rivers, then we are talking about some kind of sediment transport that have just a lag. Okay, so you just jump, makes big jumps, but the sediments still feel their weight, so they will fall down at some times. And I have the impression that when we talk about suspension in the aeolian case, we are talking about something that is what we call wash load in rivers. Is that correct or not? So something that is just leaving the bed forever. Is that correct or not?
I would say yes, but okay. People can correct me.
Yes.
So is there in the aeolian cases something similar to the difference between bed load and suspension that we have in river?
Well, saltating particles are communicating only with the bed and with the wind.
Okay.
And would that be a fair description of bed load?
The usual distinction between a bed load and suspension in rivers is the scale, once again. So bed load layer thickness is something like a few grains, and the suspension is the depth of the flow.
But isn't it fair to say in the aquatic system that the bed load particles are communicating only with the bed and with the flow? They're being dragged by the flow and they're impacting the bed.
What about the suspended part?
Pardon me?
And what about the suspension?
They're interacting purely with the turbulent velocity fluctuations.
I don't think so, because if you solve the Rouse solution, for example, that you have something that still interacts with the bed, because you still have some lag of the suspension, but there is still an interaction between the particle suspended and the bed.
I think we should distinguish between collision of suspension and turbulent suspension.
Yeah.
I mean, so you can move from bed load to collision of suspension to turbulent suspension.
Okay. The point is that because when I talk about suspension in rivers, I think of something in which it's a dilute suspension. But still, you have particle interacting with the bed, so they just do big jumps. But at the end, they will. So you have you put some sediment discharge or some sediment transport into the equation due to suspension. Is that correct? So it's not something that is leaving your bed forever.
You mean, so what is not? A suspended particle?
So you have, you can include suspension in the Exner equation, and you usually do that just to see the effect of suspension on the, on the sediment transfer. So you have, you usually split in two parts. One is usually, I'm not sure that everyone is doing the same, but so the idea is that you split the sediment transfer in one part that goes into suspension, saltation is, the saltation height is of the same order of the flow depth, and some other part moves into the bed load, and then you, to have a total sediment discharge, and you mix up the two. Is that...
Well, I would say that the total sediment discharge has a suspended component and a bed load component.
Okay. And Is that a direct analogy with the Aeolian case?
The focus so far in the Aeolian case has been on the saltating particles, which I think are the analog of the bed load in the aquatic case.
Okay.
Okay, am I right there? It's only in the strongest of winds that suspension becomes important, significant in the Aeolian case.
I understand.
Once again, does that answer your question? I mean, it seems to me that both systems contain similar mechanisms, but of varying degree, of different degrees of importance.
Okay.
So there are analogies, but the Aeolian system, from my perspective, is far simpler than the aquatic system, because inertia is playing such a dominant role.
In fact.
Michael.
You say that we know the spectral is reasonably well, which is true. But do we know it well enough to know what is the effect of a changed bed angle?
This is a nice
I think we know pretty well what happens in a flat bed.
Yeah, I forgot to
mention. But I think Kiel has some very interesting data that shows that as soon as ripples start to appear, then it can profoundly change the process.
Yes,
and
do
we understand that?
So I should correct my statement. Yeah, we know quite well the steady and free Aeolian transports in the case of flat. But I agree with you that in a rudder system, when cetacean transport occurs, so there's the formation of the ripple pattern. And then I think in a issues and how the macro roughness of the bed influence the saturation.
And the splash.
And also the splash,
so
the rebound.
In your experiments, did you also try to experiment with
no,
changing
no.
The bed angle?
But I think it's more I would say it's more the influence of the macro deformation with the saturation hop. Is there a resonance between the deformation of the bed and the length of the saturation hop?
Let me just say, shouldn't we be distinguishing between ripples and a simple inclination of a uniform bed? I mean, your experiments dealt with inclinations of inclined beds rather than.
I think we should definitely distinguish between the two, because I think the rippling is an intimate part of the saturation process. Whereas inclined bed
might be simpler in terms of describing the saltation process. That's all.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's just a slight departure.
I didn't have just inclined bed experiments in mind, but in my normal view experiments, we see what happens when
I see. You were thinking of ripples. Okay.
Yeah, I was thinking of ripples.
Okay.
And only because if you have an inclined bed, then probably the whole process is just inclined, but really
ripples
is just locally.
Okay. Jim, yeah.
Even during the actual collision, I mean, gravitation is not important.
Yeah, it's just thing.
So what affects the local behavior of the splash function is the stress. So you've got an anisotropy and stress. And that's the structure of the packing. So presumably on ripples and things, you might have different dilatancy of the thing. That can also have a big effect. So the primary effect of ripples may not be the angle. It may be latency.
Diego, Pascal, did you guys have something you wanted to share?
I think about the small scale mechanism, which can have a very important consequence, the ratio of the flux ratio between the transported sand and the bed. And so in order to understand the equilibrium between the erosion and deposition, and in fact, as we always run in the equilibrium state, we never
you know, look precisely on this number of transported sound grains which will stop and number of sound grains which will stop to be transported.
So this, I think it's a key point for a lot of application to understand this.
Yeah, so even in the simpler Aeolian system, we don't have information about erosion or deposition. Well, that comes back to the unsteady, the need for unsteady experiments.
We need unsteady theory.
Fair enough.
In fact, actually, I think we look at the field data or experiments.
So back to the comparison between
aquatic and eolians and transport. So I think that
there is a
key difference in the bed load regime because of the feedback between the motion of the particle and the fluid
velocity distribution.
So in one case it's very strong, the other case probably is not so strong.
What case strong? What case not so strong?
So I think that in the Aeolian case it should be stronger because the
particles are more massive.
And the other case much less pronounced.
But if you go to the other regimes, like the Williams regime,
suspended regime, or even the turbine suspended regime,
then the two guys are much more similar. Except that in the Aeolian case you need by far
stronger Shields number to see a collision of suspension or a turbine suspension, a full turbine suspension.
So this is different.
And sorry, so the other comment is maybe we need the experiments for the splash function in an aquatic system in order to perform an analysis similar to what has been done.
Do you think that the splash function is important in
I think
water
so.
Systems?
I definitely think so.
Because it fixed the yielding for having or not having particle ejected from the bed.
And this may be true for a force part, millimeters, but if you go to 100 microns.
But that's full suspension.
So that's why it's important to
distinguish between the regimes.
There's still a dense layer of transported grains near the base.
Yeah, so that's essentially a boundary condition. Because the most of the flow is in the fully suspended.
It's also the boundary, it's how that boundary condition changes, which is my main interest as a sedimentologist.
Yeah, I was referring to the bed load case. For the bed load case, splash function might
yeah, for example,
or river,
transport bed load, or even
but what about the issue of 100 micron particles in water? I mean, what's the appropriate description of the bed or the dense flow at the base? These particles are probably too small to describe as interacting through collisions. There's a well, then say a little bit more about that. That sounds like jargon.
It's a layer where the fluid viscous forces are dominant close to the bed. But still, that can be described.
I mean, if you know,
concentration,
can assume that concentration
dependent on this. And Joris, what kind of description do you need? What would you like to see in terms of interpreting the experiment?
I would say we need a description of the physics of what, for instance, the transition from a static bed of 100 or 200 microns to
100, 200 micron particles,
yeah,
right?
Those grains actually being in transport. So it's nice to have a description of the rheology or the process in transport, but I also need something that tells me how the boundary between what is a static bed and what is in transport, how that boundary actually changes its elevation. So what is pickup or erosion in those settings? What is the physics of entrainment of those particles into the viscous flow at its base? And at the moment,
And I think that's illustrative of that, that is really lacking. I remember a seminar given by Fotis Soteropoulos, who had an incredibly impressive model of the fluid flow through a river and around a bridge pylons. And then when he, once the particles were in that flow, it also behaved very, very well in the dilute regime that Edward mentioned. But in order for the grains to go from the bed into the flow, he had to use an empirical closure of pickup proposed by von Rein in the 1980s, which is...
No, I understand.
Which
yeah.
is like putting a Skoda bumper onto a car. That's really what it is. So it's very impressive in the fluid flow and the dilute suspension.
Yeah.
But when we need to say this sand grain is picked up from the bed, we have nothing that's based on any physics. We can only say we can just put a rate on it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is really, really lacking in aquatic systems.
Give it a DNS plus DEM, you won't get it.
Well, if you would resolve, if you could resolve the flow around the grains, perhaps, but in the simulations that Eckhart showed, there's still
only a few grains on a very small batch. So there's an issue of how you would. Could you perhaps nest that into or get some information from those small scale direct simulations that you could feed into those other models and get a better idea of pickup rates from those sorts of direct simulations?
Yeah, I mean, I think the hope would be to learn something about the physics from those small scale simulations, which then allows us to formulate some mechanisms that can be upscaled.
You can probably have enough particles in the simulations, but you can't get to the large enough remnants.
Mm-hmm.
How close to the vector in the ring number? And quite
small. No, it's affected by large structures coming in.
Yeah.
What are the Reynolds numbers, Jim?
What are the Reynolds numbers? Well, I don't know what
the Reynolds numbers
are.
Well, it depends on Reynolds number scaling with the apparatus or with the particle size?
With the apparatus.
The apparatus. Well, if you want to do DNS or 1,000.
Yeah. And in the real river or something, you have all these big turbine structures coming in, and they probably result in most of the entrainment. So this could work well with the lab scale experiments. Something else is needed to get these apparatus in.
Oh, wait, somebody. Oh, hi.
Yeah, I want to go back to the question of 1 hour micron particle size. If you go to the field and we take, let's say, all the aeolian deposits.
So you're talking about aeolian systems now.
I'm talking about aeolian.
Yeah, systems. Yours was talking about aquatic. Okay. Yeah, that's fine.
I came from the aeolian.
Yeah, I just wanted to be clear, clear.
Yeah, I'm talking about the aeolian. And we look on the grain size distribution. We can find a bimodal distribution, one for the less, where the mode will be around 50, 60 micron, and the other for the sand dunes, where the mode will be around 150 to 200 microns. And now, the 100 microns is missing. It is in between these two. And the question, where is the 100 micron particle? So one explanation is they cannot be moved by suspension, and they are not moved by saltation. Therefore, they do not accumulate eventually into a deposit.
They're left behind.
They're mixed with others in the soil, but they are not there. Maybe there are other explanations for that. Michael mentioned, I think, yesterday or the day before yesterday about what we call modified saltation, something between saltation and suspension, and very little has been done about it, which we're talking about particles that should be maybe around 100 micron, that cannot saltate, but they also cannot get so high in suspension. So maybe they are doing something like that and they falling to the ground. That can be maybe in between these two modes.
But should we worry about those particles if they're not typically present?
No, this is a question.
Why is it? Now, why are they not present?
Yeah,
okay.
This is a question. Yeah. Where is the one micron particles in the Eolian environment?
Well, and answering that question may tell us something both about suspension and saltation.
Yeah.
Marco, yeah.
Because there is a quite similar situation in rivers, actually. There is one fraction missing in a gap, let's say, between sand and gravel, what we usually qualify in river like gravel and sand. If you typically you have bimodal distribution of the sediment also in river, and there is a clear gap. That's a bigger one, I think, around 1 millimeter. If I remember, that is exactly the same situation. The question is still where that.
To follow up on what Ram said in a maybe different direction, we talked about the difference between the world experiment and the human experiment, and it's been coming out now that one difference is the turbulence spectrum. When you go to the field, then from the point of view of the time scale of the saltation, everything is very oxidation. But another difference is that in the experiments we often use a very narrow, precise distribution of sand for our experiments. But in the field, as Hein points out, we can find very broad size distribution, even bimodal or multimodal size distributions. And how does that affect the whole process? It certainly affects the splash process, that there's a mixture of fine grains and much coarser grains. But it's even more complicated than that, because if you then look at the time evolution of ripples, you'll see that the coarse grains tend to accumulate on top of the ripples. And then you also get a sort of spatial heterogeneity there. So how do we just to start to understand the splash process in a bimodal, for a bimodal sense,
we know anything about that. I do not for sure. But I think it's a very important problem for using this similar material.
It depends how you sample
your sand. If you take just from the first two layers of the ripple, of course, on the top you will get coarse sand. If you go to the top of the ripple, you will get much finer. If you take them both, you will get bimodal. But usually when we sample dune sand, we dig in the dune and we take from inside and not from the surface, because the surface is quite different because of the ripples.
So you mean it's mixed inside the
dune? Inside you get actually the position of the slip face,
yeah,
where all the sand is avalanching. And you have the mixture of all the sand. This is the right way to sample sand, sand dunes, not just from the surface or not from the rivers.
But isn't the surface playing the important role in saltation?
Yeah, but if you want to understand what are the grain sizes of a sand dunes, it's not just the surface. This is a very, very thin layer.
But if you want to understand the physics, you have to take
into
account
that.
I'm
going
to physics.
Yeah, right.
I'd just like to go back to something that Jim brought up. He kind of stole my thunder about the scale of the turbulence in rivers or in field situations, certainly in rivers and perhaps less so in Aeolian systems, is that most of the sediment is suspended dead material. That is, sediment that's picked up from the bed and transported in during suspension is in large coherent flow structures. And these small scale particle turbulent interact with, I'm not sure what role they play within these structures, but that is how most of the suspended sand is transported, is within these large structures. So I don't know whether there's any, and you can't really simulate these adequately in the lab in a flume, in that shallow flume. So I don't know whether there's any way of numerical or theoretical modeling that would address that scale of these processes.
So you don't think a modification of law-to-wall turbulence is going to help you in this context?
No, you're talking about, I think, a vastly different process here. These things are being picked up. We've got all kinds of images, acoustic images from the field that show these sand being picked up in these big structures. And as the structure is moving along and loses its energy, the sand is falling out as it's moving along. So I don't know how one addresses that in this kind of situation.
Well, these things, we saw this nice work on jets yesterday. Containment. So to get this right in numerical models is extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Whereas there are these very simple empirical rules of the entrainment velocities and functions of Richardson number.
Yeah.
So it goes this much higher level theory, which gets all this stuff right. But to deal with a direct simulation is almost impossible in any realistic case.
So
at the same time, people can make models and describe plumes and jets and all of these things extremely well and understand the mixing. And you get this problem when if you're looking at a power stone avalanche or turbidity
pattern.
It's another way, the grains are moving, so saltation starts and then it can maybe transition to suspension. Mm-hmm. So that's another sort of situation where you want to understand these things, but at some point then you want to move to classical fluid models of mixing between density in density stratified fluids. And direct simulation won't be any use there, but it's a question of parameterizing these other sort of models to work on a much higher level, incorporating these fluids and structures in them.
So at this stage, there's really no way of doing that, of simulating these coherent flow structures.
You can only do them at fairly low levels, I think.
And then that's what
LES things can do to some extent, but for practical purposes, you can do very simple calculations which tell you much better what's going to happen than in a very complicated simulation.
But what about the possibility of improving models in order to describe what Joris is seeing in the laboratory? I mean, that seems to be an interface between a rather dense fluidized layer of 100 micron particles and a turbulent dilute suspension of those same particles above that layer.
Well, the fluid mechanics one is big, what's the shear velocity, what's the Richardson number across this density, how much is it increasing, and you'd see, does it fit the standard laws for that type of thing, so you'd be approaching it in a different type of way, but in a way that's proved extremely effective. People know how to say. But then you've got to put these particle effects on top, like sedimentation particles, which is not what's normally considered. And that could have a big effect on the effective training rate, i.e. the movement of this interface. So those types of experiments might be very useful. It's remarkable how well those simple models seem to work. Situations.
So that's quite hopeful, but
we haven't done the work yet for these strongly coupled particle systems.
So I really thought the point that you're bringing up is quite interesting. So you feel it's somewhat limited what we can learn from better understanding the mechanisms by which a single particle is being picked up. You feel it's important to have a large energetic burst of fluid coming in and picking up a whole patch of sediment at once. Have people tried to, you mentioned difficulties in doing that in the lab, and I can understand that. Have people tried to perhaps do experiments where you have maybe something like a pulse jet that you can ramp up for a short time to very high energy and blast away a whole bunch of sand or something?
Andrew Hogg did some work published in coherent flow structures, I suppose, in quite a few years ago now, where he looked at the transport fed by a turbulent jet angled towards the bed, and how it created a little hole in the bed and pushed the particles and merged all of this together.
For a broader scale model, but
I don't know if anyone, I don't think anyone has looked at it in the context of kind of the other direction, what happens if you have a jet shooting up from the bed. That suspends these particles, and then as these particles get transported downstream, but sounds like what Jim was saying, that doesn't seem, I don't know whether that scale of things can be done within these physically based neural models.
But yeah, Andrew Hawk did some work like that. I think he extended it to, re-extended the suspension. I can't remember actually, but the initial one was treatment jet impacting that on the bed and how that moved the sound.
Is that right?
Yeah. Luigi? Yeah, I had a short comment on this issue. The size of the sediment matter a lot. So in the last experiment, and they also did something on that, that showed that when the flow is non aerostatic, then the field, there is an associated seepage flow in the bed. And this seepage is not causes a different force equilibrium around the single grains, and this means that strange behavior sometimes can happen. So, for example, when in my experiment I remove a gate, so I cause a downward flow. In the case where the sediment is finer, resist at the beginning, resist more, so there is no, I observe no, almost no morphological evolution at the beginning because of the seepage associated with this. So we have to look also to what is happens in the static part of the bed. So we consider static, but it is an elastic medium associated with the seepage. And I'd like to say another thing concerning the aquatic river and the difference between suspension and collision and transport mode. People like me, like Adam here, if you used to distinguish between the two modes and to treat them as completely in separate ways. So
which two modes? I'm sorry.
The suspended mode and the bedrock mode, let me say.
So, dealing with suspension, if you look at the classical books, you see that there is this RAL solution which needs a boundary condition. But where the boundary condition takes place is where probably the bed load ends. So the bed load, so the two modality coexist, and the way in which they coexist is not now. So, dealing with suspension, it is. Usually written that you have to look at the boundary condition at a certain distance from the bed, from the static bed, to grain size typically, and the concentration there, which is very important, absolutely important, determining the sediment transport, is assumed according to empirical relationship. So here there is a lot of work in order to provide the mechanical basis for all these kind of problems.
That was exactly my point before, so he has pressed it this much better than me. That was exactly my point. So we are used to distinguish among the two things as a two completely different problem. For example, in my mind, the level at which you should give the boundary condition for the concentration is exactly the top of the bedrock layer that I use in the analysis, but then this is not usually these are two things that are treated differently in the literature. Okay, so there is no continuous as long as I know, there is no continuous model that goes from bed load to suspension, just increasing the shear stress as it should be.
I would probably differ with you on that, but we can talk about that.
Sure.
And so maybe I ask you a question. So the measure of roughness is important to you in the models that you described for ripple formation, for dune formation. The roughness that is entering in the model could easily be due to the bed load itself. Is that not true? That is, the roughness, it modifies your turbulent velocity profile at the top of the bed, or at the top of the bed load region.
The answer is yes. So the answer is maybe as a first approximation, in all the analysis I show you, this is neglected. There should be an effect. I would say that in water system, this is a second order effect. So the whole thing, it's not as strong as I understand as in the Aeolian case, in which as soon as you have particle moving, sediment moving, then they will affect the roughness very much. I'm not sure that it's exactly the same in river. So I would say that as a first approximation, you can think that the fact that sediment is moving will not alter the roughness very much, the roughness felt from the flow, by the flow very much. And then, of course, you have a hill correction, but it's not so strong as in the Aeolian case, I would say.
Anybody want to comment on that? Luigi?
Yeah, in experiments, I computed the fishing hypothesis according to different sheet spectrum, meaning for flow, and there is a strong change of the fishing factor according to the sheet. So it means that I don't agree.
So
something we might talk about.
I mean,
I think that in the experimental data where you try to get the friction velocity from the velocity view, you can basically get the two. You can get a continuous roughness with a fairly continuous shear velocity, but you can also, if you basically mess up your vertical references of your elevation above the bed, you can get really pronounced roughness in your analysis, which are not actually real
physical.
Yeah, they are wrong fits of a friction velocity and a roughness to a velocity field. So I think that in a lot of experimental data, that's certainly for my own experimental data, I'm incredibly nervous about saying that there is a higher roughness just because a Z naught value comes out in a few millimeters. I don't think that's very appropriate in many experiments.
Yes, Phil?
So did you know if there is some experiments where the friction was at the bed was measured elsewhere, not with the average velocity of flow, but with a real prod lens or real friction probes at the bed? Does it exist?
I think so, but I have absolutely no experience of that. Do you have any experience?
No, not really. No, I don't know. I mean, I know in some of the old experiments I'm familiar with. No, but it just, you're talking about trying to directly measure friction or pressure at the bed. I think that's almost impossible to do in water.
There are shear stress sensors for both water and air and clear fluid.
Yeah.
I have never seen those used with sediment or any type of particles.
They sit on the bed, Alberto, or what do they do?
That's why in a solid surface, you don't have any particles.
Yeah.
Even those are very difficult to measure.
Yes, exactly.
Accurately. But if you put any type of particles on top of that, then I don't know if any sensor that will work.
Well, people do these in debris flow experiments quite a lot. If you only have a thin layer of sediment on top, they should work the same. If it's completely conforming, even if some of the stress is distributed outside your sensor, it actually ought to be symmetric. So it should still be, if it's spatially homogeneous, it should still give you the right normal and shear stress. And you can also get the pore pressure.
But if you have sand, you can look at that.
It should still be okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But, there's even one in Switzerland with real debris flows. I think in 10 years, it only has two or three sets of data on this, if it worked.
Yeah.
So it's difficult. There's a big leg cell, so it should get pore pressure, shear, and normally. Theoretically, they're all there, even if there's particles on top.
Yeah.
It should give you the data.
But what about your ability to measure particle fluctuations near the bed? Can't you infer from that what the shear and normal stress may be in the particle phase, and infer from that?
As this is also an exponential issue, to try to particle close to the depth. Because it is a law of the region or distance, so it's really difficult to, I mean, the accurate measurement for tracking particles close to the depth.
Well, if you could make those measurements of particle velocity fluctuations, could you infer then the particle shear stress, normal stress near the bend? Okay. Pardon me? Well, the situations in the Aeolian case are still rather dilute.
Yeah. It's known from meteorology, because you have these rack plates that were developed already in the 60s, but since then there's been nothing where they're working with sediment for long.
And then Diego.
I'd like to return to what you said about comparing things from the rivers to the laboratory, and of course we have this completely similar problem. Mm. We're comparing things from the field to the laboratory, because in the laboratory you use shear stress, for instance, as a key parameter. And you know that if you go to the field, then for shear stress below threshold, you still see sediment motion, because you have these low frequency gusts occasionally come in and take sediment away. So I think there's a kind of scaling between the laboratory and the field is an important issue in both communities. I also think that that's really where numerical modeling can be an important issue.
But the problem is, at that length scale, the numerical modeling is going to involve continuum modeling. Is it fair to say that? I mean, I don't see that we're going to do direct numerical simulations at that scale anytime soon. So we need to have continuum models that we have some confidence in.
We need the large scale structure in the pressure that we can do ABS.
But how do you propose taking into account significant concentrations of particles? And that's the challenge, I think.
We also heard that the LES doesn't. You can only do a high Reynolds number LES if you ignore the wall. You have to put wall walls in, otherwise you can't really get any higher.
Yeah, but at least in the atmosphere, I would think that there are two separate regions. There's one where the transport takes place, and then where basically all the energy in the fluid is being generated, because that's further up in the atmosphere where you have the production of energy. So I think we need to link the two layers together. That's, of course, I have no idea about how to do, but I think you could do less without worrying about rains getting into, because they will never get so high up in the atmosphere that they really change the behavior of your
atmosphere charges on boundary letters. Yeah. Diego, that messier. Yeah.
So back to the difference between bed load and suspension. Sorry for that. So my understanding is, my feeling is that bed load is where you have a discontinuity in the velocity, moving from the flow, in the particle velocity, moving from the flow to the bed. So there is a slip velocity kind of that. But if you have suspension, there is a continuous velocity field.
moving from the floating particle going to the air. But the question is, do we have a discontinuity also in the stresses?
In what? In the stresses?
Yes. In the Bethel case, if you compute somehow or you measure or you do whatever you want for the particle pressure, particle shear stress, those quantities are going to be continuous when you move it to the back, through the back, or not?
I think they have to.
The stress has to be continuous. Yeah. So as well, but so the velocity is continuous.
Stress has to balance the body force.
So stress is continuous and velocity is continuous.
Well, there are, I think they're different. That is, in a dilute Iolian transport regime, the particle velocity is discontinuous at the bed. Okay. An issue might be in a more concentrated or a stronger wind, when the bed is more agitated and it's not relaxing after each collision, what the situation is there. The particle phase may be brought to rest at the bed. So it's complicated. But certainly in the dilute Aeolian regime, there is a discontinuity in particle velocity at the bed. And, you know, in collisional granular flows, slip at the bed is the rule rather than the exception.
Yes. Yeah, but for the aeronimal bed, continuous.
Well, in rotable bed is an agitated bed due to collisions with a rather dense flow above it, and there that bed may bring the particle mean velocity to rest. But we don't understand that too well in the Aeolian situation. Is it fair to say that, Alexander? I mean, we understand that the single impulses in the bed that relaxes after each impulse, but as the frequency of impulses increases, the behavior of the bed becomes more complicated.
We should also beware not to be simple-minded in our approach, because we try to distinguish between we're talking about the differences between the Aeolian and the river system. But if you go to some of the rivers in Greenland, where the bed load is composed of stones of this size, and there you very often have the feeling that it's really a cheap flow of, but maybe also you have a dilute system above where you have important saltation going on in that system. It's just a matter of forces being totally different from most of the rivers that where we do our work.
Well, it seems to me you're suggesting that a Greenland river of that nature may be more Aeolian in its behavior because of the importance of inertia.
So I think there are analogies, but they're just not what we consider as an everyday experience.
Yeah, so there may be extreme systems that are providing a link.
Yeah, because there's an extreme difference in density between air and water. So you have to go to extreme systems, I guess.
Another extreme, of course, is saltation on other planets. like Venus, really. Mm-hmm. It is much, much denser, which is probably more aquatic than.
And Mars?
But that was, Michael just mentioned that because of the density of the atmosphere, the Aeolian phenomena there is more like aquatic Earth phenomena.
On Mars, where the average pressure is only 6-7 millibar, the saltation should be much faster than on Earth. And I think about maybe 30, 40 years ago, Carl Sagan wrote a paper and he called it kamikaze saltation. He said that every grain eventually will disintegrate after this storm came back.
Can I just, I noticed your list up there under morphodynamics about the turbulent shear flow in the presence of bed forms. Again, that's something that's that we've been trying to look at in the field for a long time, and a lot of people have looked at it in the laboratory under very specific types of dunes. But again, it just struck me so far in various presentations that we've had over the past month or so that I've been here that, again, everything seems to be focused on a flat bed and interaction between particles and fluids and contact between grains on a flat bed. But these large features, I think all bets are off. I mean, I think things are working very, very differently under these large features, and the flow, the motion of the fluid, the motion of the transpirative sediment, all kinds of things are being altered by the presence of these huge roughness elements. And I don't know whether subsequent presentations in the here are going to address that, or whether it's something that needs to be.
Maybe we have to answer huge compared to what? So the depth of the flow?
Yeah, for example, yeah. Sure. I mean, bed forms that are, you know, yeah, are a third of the flow depth have a major impact on what the flow does, so, and how sediment transport moves. So but I don't think we've addressed that, or I don't know whether there's any way of addressing that. As I say, it's been done in the field experimentally, but I don't know whether there's any way of addressing that in American models again, for example, as a means of tying these things together.
I think the burden's being placed on Eckert. Numerical modeling, it seems to be the solution to all of our problems.
In that context, I mean, we might, you know, we have another discussion group on Friday, right? Another discussion meeting, is that correct?
I'm not sure. What do we have?
Or maybe next week, Friday or something.
Yeah, there's a possibility then, or maybe even as early as this coming Monday. Okay. We'll see.
So we might perhaps want to give some thought, you know, experimentalists giving some thought to, you know, based on what they've seen here, what kind of simulations would they like to see? What kind of information would they ideally like to extract from simulations, you know, small-scale simulations, large-scale simulations? And at the same time, you know, based on questions raised by modelers over the last, you know, many weeks and so on, what kind of experiments would they suggest that they can do in order to address some of the issues? And then vice versa, the same thing, you know, computational people, modeling people, suggesting, okay, these might be some simulations that we could do that might be useful. These are kind of experimental data that we would love to get in order to perhaps help with our simulations, validating them or helping with closures and so on.
Any comments? That sounds fine to me.
Well, from that point of view, it might be interesting to think of particular test cases that people will run different codes on. They're all going to be exactly the same. And similarly with experiments, I mean, there's a lot of experiments which are similar, but not the same. In particular cases, we test these things and we get the identical experiments performed by different people and simulations of the same thing. There will be different formulations and interactions in different terms. Actually having everyone, well, we had some great work on the order squad, it was great, people have looked at carefully some of these things. We still have to have a group to sort of try and their approaches. Identical problems is very helpful.
Well, in a way, this comes back to one of my first comments, where I say, well, why are we not having something like the meteorological community have where they're doing testing of their models? They ran field experiments, but what your suggestion is, we could pick up some model experiments and do a similar thing there.
Yeah, Dean Iverson is planning this for the debris flow experiments of the field.
Okay.
He's describing an experiment he's going to do, and then what the debris flow people to say what's going to happen. That's a very, very complicated situation if there is, but you want to much simpler. Right.
Yes, Kevin.
Can you say something without insult?
I doubt that.
it's an issue which I care much about, because as an experimentalist, I see different facilities coming up, and I've seen a lot of experimental data being published with a kind of poor reference that would make, for instance, so how are the friction speed, how are the boundary conditions, etc. So it makes it totally impossible to compare between different sets of experiments. So there's one place in the world which is quite famous for that, except for the time being. But I think it would be important to have kind of set of guidelines for good modeling experience, both with respect to scale models and numerical models.
That perhaps also hints at another difference in the approaches. I mean, we're a very diverse community, right? We have everything from applied mathematicians and physicists to engineers to field geologists and so on. So we span a whole range of cultures, if you want to say that. And at times that came out during the discussions when some people preferred to talk about dimensional quantities and others were only comfortable with dimensionless quantities and so on. So clearly, this suggests that we're approaching these topics sometimes from different directions and different points of view. So I'm wondering if we should also think about creating a mechanism that allows us to keep the information exchange that we've developed here over the last few months going, because otherwise it's perhaps a danger that the geologists will retreat to their geology community and the engineers to their engineering community, and there won't be a regular exchange. I really enjoy the interactions with many people coming from very different points of view here, and so perhaps, towards the end of the conference, in a couple of weeks, we might want to see if there's an interest in having another follow-up workshop maybe in a couple of years, trying to bring together a similarly diverse community again. Workshop or a program? I might perhaps be a little bit too much already in a couple of years, but just a workshop.
Is this a good time to adjourn for the morning? I mean, I concur with what Eckhart said. It's just it's a question of how to imagine that taking place, what institution would foster it in a similar way. I mean, the Kevlar experience is rather unique in terms of the duration of the program, but we should explore it. Yes? Okay, so we stand adjourned until perhaps Monday, but certainly a week from this Friday, I believe. We'll see. Well, if you feel it's useful.
Yes. And this afternoon, 4 o'clock, don't forget we have a seminar. And that'll be in the room right next door here, right? In the large seminar room, main seminar room? Yeah.
Is that so?
Yeah.
Okay. And then tomorrow afternoon, not a repeat performance.
Yeah.
Thursday afternoon in chemical engineering.